The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
To have a discussion on the second part of your handout. You'll notice that with your handout there should be a list of hotlines and resources. Now, I want to emphasize that what Paul said about the church providing its own resources is really the right way to do it. I simply gathered those resources in case you were faced with a situation where someone's life or health might be jeopardized if you couldn't find a resource. Most of the resources listed on there are secular. Some have Christian roots, but you need to be aware that those resources are available. So they're listed for you, and that's one of the most complete lists that I could find. Now, our subject for the second half is obviously the various levels of government have an interest in domestic tranquility, and they have passed laws and their protections that we need to be aware of. So I've asked George Priestley, a Christian brother who's served many families in this neighborhood, in this area, to be involved in our discussions today. So, George, I appreciate your coming over and taking time out of your busy schedule.
My pleasure.
Let me just ask if you could tell us what are the primary laws that bear on domestic violence or the threat of it?
I understand you do have the written questions, so this is not going to be a well-rehearsed type presentation. Feel free to look away from me even as you review the questions. I can't see you with these lights anyway, so I won't be offended if you're not looking at me. The question suggests or asks what laws exist that bear on domestic violence or the threat of it, federal, state, or local, what legally constitutes domestic violence. I'm not aware of any laws on the federal end of things that deal with matters such as violence, domestic or otherwise. Likewise, local, if by that we're talking about townships or municipalities, there are also no particular statutes or laws that speak to violence or domestic violence, at least in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and in the state of New Jersey. And I should add at the beginning that I'm a Pennsylvania practitioner of the law, and therefore, well, you should be careful of anything I say, but particularly if you are from states or commonwealths other than Pennsylvania. The primary place where you will find statutes dealing with violence or the threat of it is on the state or the commonwealth level. Most states, there are basically two types of statutes, criminal statutes and civil statutes. A crime, as you probably know, is an act or an action against an individual that is really considered to be an action against the commonweal or everyone in the state or the commonwealth. Commonly, it's an individual who is punched in the nose or has been robbed or otherwise offended, but the action is called the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania or the state of New Jersey versus the individual. These laws, including those such as aggravated assault, simple assault, recklessly endangering another person, terroristic threats, harassment, spousal sexual assault, rape, a host of others, obviously impact in the domestic violence area as well. To the extent that anyone out in the audience thinks that these criminal laws would not apply in an interfamily situation, you are mistaken. In fact, it is very common that the perpetrators of crimes are husbands against wives, wives against husbands, children against parents, and vice versa. That's on the criminal end.
Has that always been the case, that those laws have been interpreted to cover domestic? And that's just sort of a curiosity, but do you know?
Since it's a curiosity, I'll answer it in a curious way. I really don't know. I'm not a historian in that sense with regard to the law. Jim's giving me funny looks up here. I don't think he likes where I'm going with this.
No,
there are issues such as confidentiality, or can a spouse testify against another spouse? You probably know that if you watch any TV or have any interaction with the law. Is there a prohibition against a spouse bringing or being involved in a criminal action against another spouse? The answer is no. There are certain protections available to a criminal who happens to be married to a spouse if there is communication, verbal communication or written communication, in which there's a privilege against that being used. But there is no privilege against being punched in the nose or otherwise violated.
All right. Well,
that's the criminal thing. But the main issue, the main device from a statutory point of view is found on the civil side. In Pennsylvania, it's called the Protection from Abuse Act. In New Jersey, it's called the New Jersey Prevention of Domestic Violence Act. In fact, civil proceedings, not criminal. They're very powerful tools, and one tools that all of us should be aware of as pastors, as counselors, as committed brothers and sisters in Christ, as we deal in formal ministry teams or otherwise. Briefly, just the history. Most of these kind of statutes were started in the late 70s in response to the police being reluctant to be involved in family disputes. A call comes in at 12 o'clock on Tuesday night, not to Pastor Tripp, but to the police. The police come out and they see that it's a husband and wife having some argument or worse, and historically they have not wanted to get, did not want to get involved for reasons that sound funny in 1993, but the idea was a husband, a father is the lord of the castle, and who are we to interfere? Another practical reason why the police did not want to get involved in these matters was because many times, often, that's where the police were injured or even killed, in the midst of violent domestic assaults that occurred when they were trying to break up the problem. In response to that, there were many women, particularly, who were being battered, and they weren't given, they were, you know, be warm and be filled, but not a whole lot was available to them. In Pennsylvania in 76, and most states around that time, passed these statutes that provide for a very quick hearing. Quick is a relative term when you're speaking in the terms of the law, but hearings within 10 days under Pennsylvania law, whereby a number of powerful remedies can be applied to that situation, which I'll get into a little bit later.
Okay. Then why don't we ask, just immediately jump to the second question, what are the immediate legal options open to a spouse who has been assaulted, I guess I should add, or threatened with assault by his or her partner?
Depending on the definition of how serious the situation is, an abused or spouse can call 911 or William Shatner, or get the police out there on the scene. Depending on the seriousness, again, maybe physically run and leave the premises, sometimes a difficult thing to do when there are children in the home. But again, if you are talking about a life or death or potentially life or death situation with violence abounding, that is the first practical option. Again, another option would be, in terms of an immediate option, is to contact either an attorney or certain county agencies for the purpose of filing one of these Protection from Abuse Act civil proceedings. And I must add, because I think it's very important, depending upon if the abuser is a believer, one who is claiming the name of Christ or not, and again, depending on the severity of the situation, a call to pastor or elders or care team with the understanding that the Holy Spirit can minister in these situations is something that should not be forgotten. I could tell you many war stories, I won't right now, about how the authorities get involved, and it's an appropriate exercise of their God-given responsibility in Romans 13 and beyond. But because of that intervention, it makes it more difficult sometimes for the church to be involved in the reconciliation process. So I'm not suggesting at all that the constable shouldn't be alerted or called, and in fact, many times that has to be the first immediate option. But where there is an abuser who claims the name of Christ, one ought not to forget to utilize the arm of the church. And again, more to follow on this Protection from Abuse Act petition.
Okay, so in terms of legal options or state-supported options, you're saying the first is just simply calling the police if there's a life-threatening situation. And secondly, the other legal option, the other option making use of state resources would be the obtaining a protection order.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, why don't we talk about a little bit more about that. What are the legal consequences for the offender of calling the local police into a situation of domestic violence? Because I know that sometimes comes up. Particularly wives are quite concerned with what will happen to my husband if I, what will happen to him if I need to call the police, and sometimes they can be injured simply because they are, they're afraid to call, they wait too late when there really does need to be some immediate intervention.
Right. I understand the thrust of the question. It really depends. What are the immediate consequences to the offender, to the abuser, upon the calling of the police and the police arriving at the scene? It depends on two things as I see it. First and foremost would be the physical and emotional state of the victim or the spouse or the other family member. And the other depends on the perspective that the police officer or officers have as they approach these domestic violence situations. If the police arrive on the scene and there is obvious injury that has occurred, whether it's bleeding, whether it's broken glasses, ripped clothing, obvious bruises on the person of the spouse or the family member, and especially if that victim is distraught and is arguing for her very life and safety, the police will either immediately arrest that person, and more likely will under those circumstances, than not. If in fact there is not an obvious injury that has occurred, and especially if there's another side to the story being offered by the spouse or family member who's the accused, very often the police will try to act more informally and invite or even try to scare or threaten the one who is the bigger, stronger alleged abuser out of the home until things calm down, and sort of give an informal advice to the victim to include that of filing for a protection order. The other aspect I mentioned as to what impacts on the abuser upon the calling of the police depends on the perspective that the police have. Situations where, especially if someone is experienced, they have seen a lot of these incidents, they might be more likely to listen with that extra ear to determine that there's another way to do this other than a formal legal approach. Whereas some younger police officers or police that have had a bad experience in the past with these situations, they may want to take this thing to the Supreme Court of the United States and take a very straight and narrow view, not always a wrong one, I might add, and say, I'm going to deal with this as if we have an axe murderer on the loose, and I don't care what you say, Mrs. Victim, I'm taking this guy out of here. And I mention that because it also impacts on what happens down the road, thinking about reconciliation, coming to a right relationship again with the Lord and also with the family member. That can be a problem, depending on the attitude that the officer has. When the police get involved, when the legal system gets involved, that's not inherently bad, because sin has consequences, and That can be part of the process of repentance and reconciliation, but it doesn't always work that way. At least that's my experience.
Why don't we talk about the protection order then? How is the protection order obtained and properly used?
As mentioned, it's a very, very powerful device that came about because of what the police were not doing, and in light of our understanding, our enlightened state these decades, that a lot of abuse goes on. It's powerful because of the relative speed with which assistance can be rendered, as well as the remedies that it affords. There is the provision in Pennsylvania, as well as in New Jersey, and forgive me if you're from some other state, that provides for an ex parte, a one-sided order, depending on the severity of the allegations that are made, especially if there's an allegation of weaponry being used, especially if there's obvious injury and medical attention backed up by medical records, the court is empowered to enter an immediate order as against the abuser without even hearing that person's side of it. And that order does something very powerful, which is an eviction order. Under Pennsylvania law, ultimately one can be evicted from one's home or one's apartment for up to 1 year's time. And so a quick hearing, meaning even before there's a hearing, an order can be entered, which is enforced by the police, which provides immediate relief. There is also the provision for a fast hearing, supposedly within 10 days of the filing of the petition, at which time, if there's going to be a contest or an argument as to what really happened, the abuser is given an opportunity to present his or her side of the story.
That you say that's within 10 days?
Under Pennsylvania law, it's supposed to be a hearing on the merits within 10 days. Now, these are civil matters. I mention this again. One of the sub-points under this question is there going to be a record of the matter? And if you're talking about a criminal record, the answer is no, because it's not a crime, at least under the Protection from Abuse Act. A civil proceeding, which means from an evidentiary point of view, the burden of proof is lesser than for a criminal matter. Those of you who, instead of reading your Greek texts, watch LA Law, you understand beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a criminal standard, as compared to the preponderance of the evidence, which is a more likely than not standard, a lesser standard. Evidence such as medical records can be placed in. Usually it's, and very often it's just one person's word against the other, except if there's real violence, physical violence or threat of same, it's often accompanied by physical bruises. You take pictures, you get medical records, although it's not favored, family members testify, perhaps neighbors, depending on how thick your party walls are and things of that sort. I should say that very often, you don't go to a trial on the merits, whether it's because the abuser realizes that he or she went overboard and really did some damage or injury, or whether they don't want to have to go through the time and expense and embarrassment of actually trying the case. I would say a good majority of the actual protection from abuse cases result in orders being entered by agreement. And again, the significant thing there is, at least from my perspective, less that there's some formal record trotted out for posterity than there is relief afforded. And that relief primarily is the eviction order. It can also include temporary financial support for spouse and children. It can also include temporary provisions for custody and visitation issues. So within a 10-day or 2-week period after this violent event, the courts of our counties can administer swift and decisive remedies to these situations.
Okay. Do you think that an attorney is necessary or advisable for a person seeking a protection order, or can they just drive to, I guess in our case it would be Norristown, and give me a little bit more on the mechanics of if you needed to advise someone to pursue this direction, how would you tell them to go about it?
I believe this man is asking a lawyer if they need a lawyer. If I heard you correctly, it is not necessary. It is often advisable for the following reason. There is a framework within some of those organizations listed in the material for organizations to provide the immediate kind of filing of those petitions and some supposedly relatively quick action. The problem is those organizations are often overworked and overburdened, and just depending, especially on the county in which you are living, you may not get the kind of fast relief that is designed to be achieved with these kind of actions. And oftentimes there is and I'm painting with a broad brush, and that's always dangerous, but sometimes there's not the attention to the detail that often needs to be developed in the filing of these petitions when you go to agencies, county agencies, legal aid societies, and so forth. So absent, you know, whether it's financial reasons or otherwise, I think an attorney can be a very useful part of the team in getting this done. You file the petition, which is basically a factual summary. Usually you start from the most recent incident, and normally that's not the first time there have been problems, and so the petition lays out serially what has happened. And we're talking about physical abuse or threat of it. We're not talking about my husband or my wife is mentally abusing me and calling me names, mm-hmm. And you understand where I'm going here. It's a device that deals with physical violence or the threat of it. Better to have a lawyer than not, because it's the forum is where lawyers hang out.
So it's a county court that administers it, though it's a state law, and so that means the hearing would normally be at the county seat.
Correct.
Is that right?
And here in Montgomery County, the county seat is in Norristown, Doylestown for Bucks County, mm-hmm. Philadelphia for Philadelphia County, and so forth. But the laws are statewide and administered by each county.
If a person didn't have access to a lawyer for some reason, could they go to the county courthouse, and does the county itself have any state-supported resources to help a family member fill out a form and file, even though they wouldn't have they would at least have the advice of the clerk or something mm-hmm. that would.
Right. Well, even more than that, though, Jim, the Legal Aid Society is what it's called in Bucks County. Community Legal Services is what it's called in Philadelphia County, and I forget what it's called here in Montgomery County. But they are organizations that are funded by our tax dollars that deal with these kind of emergency issues, and there are particular people within those offices that prepare and present these kind of petitions.
Another question that occurs to me that if a person has a as I understand, that is it possible to have a protection order that would simply say, if you ever do this again, you will be arrested, but it's not necessarily an eviction. In other words, the person, it could be a deterrent to further violence, but not necessarily an eviction.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. It's been my experience in recent years that the courts are not inclined to give half a loaf. Whereas there is nothing that requires an eviction. For example, the order routinely says you are ordered not to threaten, harass, or abuse your spouse and the children or whoever else is in the home. It also routinely involves, but by statute does not have to involve, the eviction. That, of course, is the most powerful of the remedies in terms of the immediate problem of violence. It also, by the way, normally or typically includes a stay-away order, not only from the residence, but also the place of employment or school or wherever you might be. But it doesn't have to. But it's been my experience that recently, and again, I'm generalizing, the judges are not inclined to order that you not abuse or harass or threaten, and that let that person continue to live in the residence. The court is basically taking the position, you got some real problems here, and you're almost inviting another problem, perhaps a more serious one, and so either you withdraw your petition or you take the full measure of the law.
Mm-hmm.
One other point I'd like to make, and I've done this on occasions, and it's always a special joy. If for example, talk about the care or ministry team that Paul was addressing in the first half hour, I have had occasion to place in an agreement, and again, remember I said many of these work out in an agreement context, to deal in that order, that agreement, a commitment for counseling. And I've had an opportunity to be very specific as to where the counseling takes place. Obviously, my preference would be for counseling from a biblical perspective, even more direct than that, through the church, for those who have to give an account someday for the people in their midst, and tie certain changes in the order to participation and by God's grace, improvement in their relationship. That's always a special joy to be involved in that. It's not obviously the routine approach that's taken by the courts or most lawyers.
Can a ministry team institute this documentation? Or it must be the person that has the violence against?
Under Pennsylvania law, the only one who can bring the action is the victim. Under New Jersey law, I am told, if the police arriving on the scene see obvious injury, the police have the authority to bring the action. But the ministry team, to follow your question, would be seen as a do-gooder outfit that should stay away from, go hand out tracts, but don't come in my way. That's the way the courts, and again, I'm generalizing, would view that. You have no standing as a church to be bringing an action, at least in the law courts. Ecclesiastically speaking, that's what